We have the Elohim who have Elion. We have the Theoi who have Zeus. We have Elion who makes a division. And in the Bible, Yahweh had an inheritance. That is, he was assigned Jacob's people, Jacob's descendants, and a very important phrase. At a certain point it says, Yahweh guided him alone. There was no foreign God with him. Here the Bible specifies that after having obtained an inheritance, an assignment, it tells us that Yahweh took care of it alone. And this is important because it means that other Elohim took care of others, or perhaps even some Elohim had not received assignment. Here, I read you a printout of some passages from Plato's Critias. Plato tells us how that assignment was made. In the past, therefore, the gods divided the whole earth into very different territories, which were then assigned by lot without therefore arguing. So Plato tells us, exactly like the Bible, that those territories were assigned, but he also tells us that they were assigned by lot. And what did the gods do? They raised their own possessions and their own creatures, just as shepherds do with their flock, without using any physical violence. Yahweh did a little more, but we know that he was a soldier. Not like the shepherds who take the animals out to graze by whipping them, but rather, as is usually done with a tame animal, guiding it from behind as if it were a rudder, demonstrating that you were able to convince it and conquer its soul according to a well-defined project. In doing so, they guided and governed the entire human race.
Mauro Biglino is an internationally best-selling Italian author, researcher, and highly regarded scholar of ancient Hebrew. For many years, he worked for Rome's St. Paul Press as a Bible translator, providing with great precision the literal meaning of Hebrew words for Vatican-approved interlinear Bibles. It is an exacting discipline. The scholar must be rigorous in avoiding any kind of interpretation of the word and give only the literal etymological meaning of each word part. Mauro's findings set him at odds with the conventional expectations of the Catholic world and propelled him onto the international stage, where his work has opened up a world of cultural memory recorded in the Bible. Yet hidden from the public for centuries by mistaken translation and the dogmas of the church.
Good morning. Today we see some general considerations on the figures of these Elohim and Theoi. In the previous video, I talk about the relationship between the Bible and Homer, let's say in particular, but between the Bible and the Greek world in general. So both the Bible and the Greek world speak of these individuals who are called Elohim in the Old Testament and are called Theoi in the so-called Greek myths. I say so-called myths because, as you know well, exactly as for the Bible, also for the tales of Greeks and for the Homeric tales in particular, I choose, and I declare this methodological choice of mine, I choose to pretend that they are true. That is, I choose to pretend that in essence they have maintained and reported the memory of events that actually occurred. This is fundamental for me, because it is a method that, in my opinion, helps us understand the past and also helps us connect the past to the present. Above all, it also means respect for the ancient authors. The worst thing that, in my opinion, can be done is to deny its validity a priori, to dismiss it outright without giving it proper consideration, which has been done for centuries and which unfortunately some still do. But despite the widely demonstrated fact that if one pretends that what was told by the ancients is true, many important discoveries can truly be made, and they prove to be important, even for those who persisted in denying the historical validity of ancient texts. For example, regarding Homer, we know that in the 19th century a merchant Schliemann pretended that the Iliad and the Odyssey essentially contained history, the memory of a truly verified fact. And we know what he discovered. Luckily, he carried on, despite all the attempts to stop him, despite all the sarcasm that surrounded him, despite the attacks, indeed, of which he was subjected by a part of the academic world who said to him, "But what do you want? Leave it to us, because in short, it's not your business. Luckily, he went on, he didn't care about those attacks. And I say luckily not only for all of us, but also for those same people who would have wanted to force him to stop. But he didn't do it. And therefore, applying to the Homeric poems, and in general, the method that I apply to the Bible, is the same method that I apply to the Greek stories. Important discoveries can be made, and above all, the possibility of knowing is not precluded, because otherwise a priori one would say they are just fairy tales, and therefore one would stop, but woe betide one to stop. Luckily, Schliemann didn't stop, and after Schliemann, others. Now, since the Bible talks to us about the Elohim and the Greeks, Homer in particular, talk to us about the Theoi, we are faced with two groups of individuals, and we will see this in a next video, who have a whole series of absolutely similar characteristics, I would even say overlapping, and for example, both in one case and the other. And at the end of this video, among other things, we will see a truly unexpected, almost unthinkable Platonic curiosity. I repeat, both in the Bible and in the Greek texts, there is talk of this group of individuals who were obviously commanded by one who was the Lord of all, that is, by a leader who in one case was Zeus, and who in the Bible is instead called Elion. Elion means what is above, so it is a sort of attribute, and remember this term because it is very important in what we will say in a few minutes. Elion is an attribute, it is not a proper name, and indicates precisely what is above, that is, what commands. In the course of tradition, obviously when Yahweh, i.e. the governor of the people of Israel, was made to become the most important of the Elohim, and then even attempted to make him the only God to turn to, then steps were taken over the centuries by the Jewish tradition to also identify Yahweh with Elion, which he absolutely is not. Let's take an example, and we take the example from the oath that Abraham makes when he participated in the so-called campaign of the four kings. We are therefore at a war. We are in Genesis 14. And Abraham meets Melchizedek, who is defined as Cohen of Elion. That is, the acting, the one who looked after Elion's interests in a certain territory. Normally, this territory is identified with Jerusalem, because the name in Hebrew would be Salem. Others read Shalon, and say that in reality it is precisely a territory which is instead found in the West Bank, and which tradition would then slowly make disappear to replace it with Jerusalem. Because tradition does not accept giving too much importance to that other territory. But let's pretend that Melchizedek was Cohen, that is, priest of Elion in Salem, that is, in Jerusalem. Then, Melchizedek offered bread and wine, and blessed Abram with these words, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, creator of heaven and earth." And then, Abraham says, "I lift up my hand before the Lord, God Most High, creator of heaven and earth." That is, he swears his oath of loyalty to the commander, and here it says, "I raise my hand before the Lord, the Most High God." In fact, in the Masoretic Bible, in the verse, it is written like this. "I raise my hand before Yahweh," which is then identified with El Elyon. And now we see exactly the verses examined as they are written both in the Masoretic text and in the Qumran text. And we will have a little surprise. So, this is the verse we're talking about, and we see it in the two versions. This is the Masoretic Bible version, and we see it now. You see that it is written here, although obviously those who do not know Hebrew can still see the difference, which I will highlight. That here it is written that Abraham raises his hand, El Yahweh, that is, to the Lord, El Elion. That is, here it is written that Abraham swears in front of Yahweh, identified with El Elion, that is, the Lord who is above, the Lord who commands. If instead we go forward and look at the same passage in the Qumran texts, that is, much older than the Masoretic text. We see that Abraham swears, then raises his hand, exclusively in front of Elion. Yahweh absolutely does not appear here. Among other things, you see that there is also a difference with the previous verses. Here you see that there are dots and dashes that are missing here, because this is the text vocalized by the Masoretes, while the Qumran text has obviously never been vocalized. Therefore, this is another of the differences, and then there is another aspect that we now return to review. Here it is said that Abraham raises his hand, swears in front of Yahweh, which is not there in the Qumran texts. El Elyon, and here there is Koneh, which is normally translated as creator of the heavens and the earth. But let's talk about this now in a moment, to understand that even here the translations are very misleading. Have you seen in the Qumran texts, i.e. the most ancient ones, Yahweh is not there. Yahweh was inserted later. There is only talk of Abraham swearing in front of Elion. That is, Abraham is officially accepted within that military alliance by swearing in front of the great leader, but Yahweh is not there. Yahweh was only inserted later. Then I pointed out that there is Koneh. Now this Koneh is translated, as we have just read, with El Elyon Koneh, that is, creator of the heavens and the earth. In reality, Koneh means something completely different. If we take this dictionary of Hebrew etymology, written by Matityahu Clark, based on Samson Raphael Hirsch's commentaries, we take the verb Koneh, i.e. the root Kana. He writes very clearly that the root Kana, from which Koneh derives, means acquire by legal means. That is, acquire through legal means that have nothing to do with the act of creating. So there in the Bible, it is written that El Elyon was the owner, not the creator, of the earth. The owner, that is obviously being the great head of the empire, is the one who owns it. And among other things here, the text also mentions those verses of Genesis 14:19 where it says, having legal right. That is, he had legal rights. He was not a creator. You understand that the difference is substantial, because in the Bible, the concept of creation is not there, let alone the concept of creation from nothing. And so, here we have a first biblical curiosity, then Elion corresponds to Zeus. The Elohim were under him, just as the Greek Theoi were under Zeus. But there is another aspect that refers us to the division of the lands carried out by Elion. And we look at it in the Bible, in Deuteronomy 32:8, where it is told, where Moses tells what Elion did. And in verse 8 of chapter 32, it says, when the Most High divided the nations, when he separated the sons of men, he established the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. Now this frankly appears a little illogical, in the sense that it cannot have divided the peoples and defined the borders of all the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. So much so that something else is written in the Qumran texts. Once again, in the most ancient texts, it is written that Elion made the division on the basis of the children of the Elohim. And this has its own meaning. This has its own logic. And now we see it. Here you see the difference. And in this case, I prefer to print the page of the 4Q Dawit J fragment, that is, the Qumran fragment, because at least this way it is more readable. Even those who do not know Hebrew are able to grasp the difference between what is written here and what is written here. Here we are in the Masoretic Bible, where it is written that the division was made by Elion on the basis of the number of the children of Israel. And instead in the Qumran text, it is written that the division was made on the basis of the number of the children of the Elohim, therefore with a clear difference. This one has its own logic, this one has much less. Have you seen the substantial difference here too? Then the addition of the Vetus Testamentum in volume 57, where there is a whole series of studies relating precisely to this passage that we have seen, and where we try to give an explanation of the way in which we went from being children of the Elohim to children of Israel. But this is the fundamental thing, that Elion made the division on the basis of the number of the Elohim, that is, on the basis of the number of the so-called divinities. And here we return to the relationship with the Greeks. So, we have the Elohim who have Elion. We have the Theoi who have Zeus. We have Elion who makes a division. And in the Bible, always in the same passage, it is said that on that occasion, that is, on the occasion of the division, Yahweh had an inheritance. That is, he was assigned Jacob's people, Jacob's descendants, and, a very important phrase, at a certain point it says, Yahweh guided him alone. There was no foreign god with him. That is, here the Bible specifies that after having obtained an inheritance, an assignment, and it does not tell us what the criteria are on the basis of which the assignment was made. The criteria were the number of the children of the Elohim, but then each had its people. So someone had a large people, someone like Yahweh, had a very small people, so we don't know the criteria. But it tells us that Yahweh took care of it alone. And this is important because it means that other Elohim took care of others, or perhaps even some Elohim had not received assignment. Well, let's then come to the Greek tales, which essentially refer to the same type of story. Here, I read you a printout of some passages from Plato's Critias. There, in the Critias, Plato tells us how that assignment was made. In the past, therefore, the gods divided the whole earth into very different territories, which were then assigned by lot without therefore arguing. So, Plato tells us, exactly like the Bible, that those territories were assigned, but he also tells us that they were assigned by lot. And what did the gods do? They raised their own possessions and their own creatures, just as shepherds do with their flock, without using any physical violence. Yahweh did a little more, but we know that he was a soldier. Not like the shepherds who take the animals out to graze by whipping them, but rather, as is usually done with a tame animal, guiding it from behind as if it were a rudder, demonstrating that you are able to convince it and conquer its soul according to a well-defined project. In doing so, they guided and governed the entire human race. Plato speaks to us of a domesticated species, but it is not finished. So, the gods commanded and managed the various territories received by lot. Hephaestus and Athena, however, have a common nature, not only because they are brother and sister born from the same father, but also because both are lovers of art and philosophy. Yahweh, on the other hand, was war-loving. They both received only one lot. So, this is a sort of counterpart to what we read before. Here we have Hephaestus and Athena who receive a single lot. In the Bible, it is written that Yahweh took care of the people assigned to him alone. It's wonderful, because truly, if we forget for a moment what the artificial meaning has been attributed to the Bible, we realize that in reality, they are telling us exactly the same events. Here in Critias, we are even told that the assignment was made with the drawing. The Bible does not say how the assignment was made. Well, here we have one more statement, and this is fantastic in my opinion. But there's more. Elohim is a term that, as you know, I always say it would be best not to translate because in reality, no one knows for sure what it means. Among the translations that are proposed, there is that of judges, powerful people, legislators. Now, as you understand, all these are attributes, that is, to say that someone is a judge presupposes that we know who is the one who then acts as a judge, or does the legislator, or governs. But he is an individual who must be defined in some way. In reality, everything used to translate the term Elohim is nothing more than an attribute of their functions. Well, Miguel de Unamuno, professor of classical philology and also dean of the University of Salamanca, in a very interesting book of his, speaking of the term theoi, says that originally theoi was an attribute, and that only later was it made into a noun. And he writes of, when the rationalists substantiated the term God, i.e., theos, which is properly an adjective, a predicated quality of each of the gods. I.e., theos is not a noun meaning God. It became a noun God then, as far as the Bible is concerned, with the Vulgate of Jerome, who translated it with deus, and then to this term, deus, was attributed all that set of meanings that we know and which are part of the theological tradition. In particular, Christian theological tradition. Well, he says that therefore, they subsequently added the article and shaped the God. But originally it was an attribute, or rather, it was actually an adjective that indicated a function of those there. Well, the term theos has Indo-European origins, and we are going to look at it in the Dictionary of Indo-European Languages, where the term rekotheos is traced back to the Indo-European root dei, which indicates the act of going quickly towards the light, throwing oneself high, flying, running, and was, for example, attributed to the stars. This is a dictionary of Indo-European etymology. What does Plato say again? Plato says that the stars were originally called theoi. Why? Because they always saw them driven by a continuous and very fast movement, and they called them gods due to their nature of running, and the verb from which the term theoi derives is theian. Now let's think about how interesting this aspect is. We saw it before in the Dictionary of Indo-European Etymology, this meaning of flying upwards, throwing oneself towards the light. And here we have the term theoi, which was an identifier for the stars, that is for this, their movement in the heavens. And then it was passed on to indicate individuals, but to indicate their function. As Miguel de Unamuno told us, that is, what was the function that the ancients saw in these individuals to get to the point of calling them and defining them theoi? Evidently, it had to be the function that they had previously identified in the stars that we saw in the Indo-European dictionary, where it is said that it was the function of going fast in the sky. So this is truly fascinating. We have the Elohim, who have at their head Elion, who, among other things, is translated as Altissimo, but it is not a superlative, let alone an absolute superlative. In Hebrew, it means exclusively what is above. Therefore, translated with Altissimo already means inventing a translation. We have the Theoi, headed by Zeus. These, both Elohim and Theoi, understood as terms, indicate functions. For Elohim, it is more difficult to identify them. For the term Theoi, we have both an identification from a dictionary and that of Plato, which indicates this rapid movement in the heavens. And therefore, we are truly faced with a situation that makes us think of a possibility of overlap. Bye, thanks, and see you next time.